Welcome to this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am George Hammond, the chairman of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. We also welcome our listening audience, both on the radio and online, and we invite everyone to visit us at www.commonwealthclub.org. It is my great pleasure to introduce our speaker today, Gene Hammond, director of the writing program at the State University of New York, Stony Brook, on Long Island. Taught at the University of Maryland for 25, 30 years, and then at Murray Private School in Washington, D.C., for maybe another 10 years or so. He was educated at Notre Dame. Then he went to Oxford on a fellowship, and then Yale for his Ph.D. He wrote his thesis on Jonathan Swift, Erasmus, and Thomas More, if I remember correctly. And he's going to be speaking about the philosophy of ironing. We're not just what he wrote about, but why is irony used? And of course, Jonathan Swift was one of the great ironists in history. And the only other thing I have to say about this speaker is that he's probably the best oldest brother any philosopher ever had in the history of philosophy. So I give you my brother, Gene Hammond.
Thanks, George. Nobody ever learned more from a younger brother than I have from George. Irony has been a lifelong passion of mine. The very first course I got to teach when I was a graduate student at Yale was in irony. And I actually have not taught a course in irony ever since, because Yale had an open system for setting up courses that no place else I've been has had since then. But irony is both very rare, in the sense that of all the great writers we've had in history, only a handful have been great ironists. It's also very common. We all use it in our everyday life all the time, with our spouses, with our family, with our friends. I think it's fascinating, and it's powerful. And most of all, what I like about it is it's an antidote to conventional thinking. And I hate conventional thinking, I guess. So it gives me an affinity for irony. So what is irony? First definition of irony is that it's a pretense of ignorance and willingness to learn. And that definition obviously comes from Socrates, because Socrates pretended that he wanted to learn from the people he was talking to. But really what he wanted to was upset them from their ordinary way of thinking. So the term irony comes from the Greek word iron, which means the dissembler. And they called Socrates the dissembler. So it had, an inconspicuous start, except that Socrates was so good at it. The second definition of it, which is the word that I use mostly as a literary critic, is the use of words to mean something other than, and especially the opposite of, what the literal meaning is. So that's the trick if you're writing irony, is to use some words, but to convince people that you mean something else than what you said. And it's not easy to do. So a very obvious and simple example is Henry Fielding, who wrote Tom Jones, also wrote a play called Tom Thumb the Great. And already you're supposed to laugh, but, I mean, you don't have to laugh at me, but he wants you to laugh because Tom Thumb can't be great. Tom Thumb is this little, you know, person the size of a thumb. So he's questioning what the word great might mean. And then the third meaning, which we use very commonly, and one of the reasons why people are confused about irony, is it's any kind of incongruity between what you expect to happen and what happens. And so I think about 10 years ago, as Alanis Morissette wrote a song called Isn't It Ironic, and had all kinds of kind of silly things on there, like it rained on my wedding day or something like that. So she calls that ironic. And a lot of people do, because it's sort of unexpected. You expect a wedding day to be beautiful, so, or maybe some people do. In San Francisco, you probably can count on it if it's not the winter. So things like, just typical examples, like for Nixon to make open up the doors to China could be seen as ironic, because wouldn't expect a conservative president to do that. Or for Clinton to balance the budget can be considered ironic, because you didn't expect a liberal to do that. Okay, so then the harder question is, that if that's irony, what's the philosophy of irony? And I think the principal philosophical questions that I can connect with irony is, first, what's the nature of irony? What's the ontology of it? And I'll talk about that some today and ask you to tell me more. Secondly, is what wisdom does irony offer us? You know, if the purpose of philosophy is to find wisdom, then does irony have any special brand of wisdom to offer? And third, related to that, I think, is what effect does it have on its readers? What effect does irony have when you use it on your readers? And I hope those are questions that you'll ask me things about tonight. A little example of how effective irony can be is if it were a little colder tonight and it were raining and it were sleeting, okay? And it had been sleeting for maybe 2 or 3 hours. And so everybody, when they were trying to get here, had a hard time getting here, either walking or driving because of the sleet. And you'd felt miserable coming in. If I met any one of you in the bathroom before this talk, and I said, nasty weather, you would probably say, yeah, nasty weather, right? But if I said, nice weather, you and I would have formed a bond, probably, because I've said something that is not true, and I've shown you this respect that says, I know that you know that it's not true, and therefore, even though we've never met before, we have this common ground that we understand this is really nasty weather, but we call it nice weather, and we know that means nasty. Okay? Now, it obviously gets more complicated than that, but I think that's one of the good everyday examples of how we use it. and the link we make with our listeners and readers when we do use it. Okay, who has practiced irony in history? It's a fairly short list, I think. One of the places to start is with Taoism, actually. Many of the slogans or the proverbs connected with Taoism, which starts from Lao Tzu, or at least traditionally starts from Lao Tzu in the 6th century BC, have an ironic touch to them. So let me just read a few of the quotations that I gleaned from that I've used in this way. To lead the people, walk behind them. To lead the people, walk behind them. That makes you stop and think about what it means to lead, right? And it also makes you stop and think about, well, what the meaning of the word lead is, okay? Makes you think in general. And you'll stay very puzzled for a while. But there's also some sense to it, right? When you hear that, you think, oh, that's not wrong, but what kind of sense is there in it? Okay, another example. In governing, don't try to control. Good advice for parents, right? Maybe good advice for political leaders. In governing, don't try to control. Again, there's a little humor in it. A couple of you laughed, okay? But it makes you think about what is the word control all about? It takes the word control and examines it. And it implies that we still do want to control other people. I want to control you all for this next half hour or hour. But how am I going to do it? Am I going to do it by bullying you or some other way? Another example. The sage never strives for the great, and thereby the great is achieved. By reading this one, I think that irony indicates, among other things, that words are not very capable of explaining the way we perceive things. To strive for the great, don't strive for the great, and thereby the great is achieved, means that there may be two different definitions of great going on there, you know, and that the word, the single word, is not enough to explain. And the other thing that it indicates is that human psychology plays a large part, so that if you strive for the great, you would think there's a logic to doing that. You'll get there. But humans don't work as directly as words work, and therefore it doesn't work, or at least according to Taoism, it doesn't. A couple more examples from Taoism. If you want to be given everything, give everything up. Similar to Jesus' message, or one of Jesus' message. And finally, maybe one of the hardest ones to stomach, throw away morality and justice, and people will do the right thing. throw away morality and justice, and people will do the right thing. Okay, if you really try, I've tried this with my 8th graders, to get them to try to follow up on these Taoist principles, it ties them in knots, you know, because they can't imagine how they can use them to get to where they want to go. Okay, so that's one place where you get the origin of irony, and actually the actual statements of Taoism are more paradoxes than irony. And the difference between paradox and irony is sometimes hard to explain, but a paradox is something that seems to be a contradiction but turns out to have some psychological sense. And irony is not necessarily a contradiction, but it's just that the word as you've used it needs to be thought of in a different sense. they often overlap, but they're not always the same thing. Okay, so the other source of irony is Socrates, and that's the one that probably in our culture has the most effect. I wanted to talk a little bit about Plato's Gorgias, which is just one of his many dialogues, in which the point is to change the other people, his interlocutors' notion of happiness. So Socrates comes along, he's talking to a rhetorician that tells Socrates that his name is Gorgias, that he can make anybody happy because he can teach them how to speak to other people and get what they want. Okay? He's what they call a rhetor in ancient Greece. And Socrates just starts asking him questions and asking him questions, and by the end of the dialogue, he's totally confused about how to make people happy. Gorgias asserts that we all envy the leader with unlimited power, and we would all like to have the license to do whatever we think is in our best interests. Most of us would not argue with that. You know, it would be great to have unlimited power. It would be great to be able to do whatever we thought was in our best interest. But Socrates replies, in a long dialogue, that leaders who act unjustly are to be pitied rather than envied, because there is nothing worse than doing wrong. Not being wrong, but doing wrong. Everybody else seems to think, you know, if you've got the power and you can do whatever you want, you know, what else could you want in life? But Socrates argues little by little by little, actually, and gets actually the other people to say it, that if you get exactly what you want and you feel guilty about it, then there's no pleasure in it, okay? And if you are even if you are persecuted by the person who gets everything he wants and is persecuting you as part of his pleasure, you will feel better about yourself being persecuted, even if you're tortured, he says, put on the rack, than will the person who's persecuting you. And so what he's trying to do ultimately, I think, is get the other people in the dialogue to change their notion of what happiness is. And he does it by attacking our conventional notions that we all seem to take for granted and then little by little by little undermining them. I did it much too fast here for you to be convinced, I'm sure. That you would rather be tortured than being the torturer. Kierkegaard, Soren Kierkegaard, who was a 19th century Danish philosopher, and among other things, he was a multi-talented person, he believed that Socrates was trying to get at the origins of subjectivity, because he said he's not just trying to get the person to change their mind about happiness. What he's really trying to do is to get the person to think about happiness. Okay? Instead of just accepting what ordinarily people accept about happiness, which is, you know, you want the biggest, most powerful job, the most money, the biggest Cadillac, whatever the equivalent was in ancient Greece, that Socrates doesn't really expect you to buy into, okay, I'm going to go and get tortured so I can feel good about myself. But he's getting to say, well, wait a second, maybe you really don't get happy the way people traditionally think. And Kierkegaard is one of the founders of existentialism. I think it's interesting that he found that element in Socrates. So who practiced irony after Socrates and Lao Tzu? The list is fairly small. I wonder kind of if those of you in the audience could shout out people that you know of or you think of as ironists.
Voltaire,
absolutely. Who else?
Woody Allen.
Woody Allen, yes. Mark Twain, he's on my list. Jane Austen, definitely. In fact, there's just one book, Mansfield Parker, where she didn't use irony, and most people like that the least of her books. Gibbon, in The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. And actually, Jonathan Swift, when he was writing, many, many people in the 18th century were using irony. It was fashion of the day, Voltaire in France doing the same thing, along with Diderot and La Rochefoucauld and others. But the list is not infinite as to who wrote ironically. One person who wrote before Swift, who I think got a lot of people in Europe thinking about irony, is Erasmus. And his most famous work is The Praise of Folly. And you can tell just from the title that what he's doing is trying to praise something that is not ordinarily praised. And what he was doing, in one sentence, is trying to attack various forms of conventional wisdom of the day and saying it's better to be foolish for various reasons and in various ways than it is to be wise in the ways that people are conventionally wise. And Erasmus was respected for these ideas, but nobody followed him, really. They kept on doing it the way they had been doing it before. Now, I'd like to read a couple of passages from some of the people I mentioned or you mentioned. First one is from Voltaire, actually, so that you can start to see in individual words how a writer uses the irony. This is from chapter 3 of Candide, and it's when Candide is fighting in a battle between the French and the Germans. And here's the description. "Never was anything so gallant, so well accoutred, so brilliant, and so finely disposed as the two armies. The trumpets, fifes, oboes, drums, and cannon made exquisite harmony. The entertainment began by a discharge of cannon, which, in the twinkling of an eye, laid flat about 6,000 men on each side. At length, while the two kings were causing Te Deums to be sung in their camps, Candide took a resolution to go and reason somewhere else about causes and effects." I skipped a couple things in the middle there. But there are a lot of words there that the Voltaire clearly doesn't mean to be taken in the conventional sense. So he says, this was so gallant. Obviously, some people see war as gallant, but Voltaire is not seeing war as gallant. We don't know that yet. So well accoutred. Ah, everybody's dressed as we would wish them to be dressed. So brilliant, you know, generals. So finely disposed. They like the organization, right? We get with these books still today that show how we lay out the armies and all the famous battles in history. Exquisite harmony in the music. And then he says the entertainment began, okay? Clearly that word is supposed to be taken in its opposite sense. So there's the irony there. And we don't really know entirely that we are supposed to take it ironically till he says that in an instant 6,000 men were killed. And then from that point on, we start to get the details that undermine it. Another example from Gibbon, Edward Gibbon, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. This is a description of the rise of Christianity in the midst of the Roman power at the time. "But how shall we excuse the supine inattention of the pagan and philosophical world to those evidences which were presented by the hand of God, not to their reason, but to their senses? During the age of Christ, of his apostles and their first disciples, the doctrine which they preached was confirmed by innumerable prodigies. The lame walked, the blind saw, the sick were healed, the dead were raised, demons were expelled, and the laws of nature were frequently suspended for the benefit of the church. But the sages of Greece and Rome turned aside from the awe-inspiring spectacle, and pursuing the ordinary occupations of life and study, appeared unconscious of any alterations in the moral or physical government of the world." You can't point to single words there as easily, but obviously he is looking at a conventional way of looking at Christianity and saying, well, wait a second, why did no intelligent Romans notice this when it was happening? And Jane Austen, I can't remember the exact quotation, maybe some of you can help me with this, but the beginning of Pride and Prejudice. "Is it a truth universally acknowledged that a young man with a large estate," that's the part I can't remember, "must be in want of a wife?" Okay, that sets up the whole premise for the novel, that the women in the area have to, you know, try to get Mr. Bingley. Obviously, he's using, or she's using, language, must be in want of a wife, that people use, okay? But she wants you to read it in an opposite sense. Obviously, you know, there's no reason why he should be in want of a wife. I have a couple of quotations from Mark Twain, but I think I'll move on to Jonathan Swift, because I think Jonathan Swift worked harder at trying to make irony effective and to make it more complex than anybody else did. Most of you probably know Gulliver's Travels, and most of you probably know A Modest Proposal. So I'm going to stick with A Modest Proposal as the most obvious and briefest example. What Swift often did, and he did this in little pamphlets all of his life, is instead of asserting his position in the pamphlet, or instead of asserting an opposite position, he would take an in-between position where, not necessarily in between, but he would create a new voice, a new persona, where the person had about half the story right and half of it wrong. And Swift enjoys putting that person in that situation where you start reading this person and you think, oh yes, I agree. Whoops, I don't agree anymore. But the person just carries on and just keeps going, and the logic of his own argument takes him forward. So, assuming that you remember several parts of the Modest Proposal, I'm going to just read a couple of passages. The number of souls in this kingdom being usually reckoned 1.5 million, of these I calculate there may be about 200,000 couples whose wives are breeders, from which number I subtract 30,000 couples who are able to maintain their own children, although I apprehend there cannot be so many under the present distresses of the kingdom. But this being granted, there will remain 170,000 breeders. I again subtract 50,000 for those women who miscarry or whose children die by accident or disease within the year. There only remains 120,000 children of poor parents annually born. The question, therefore, is how this number shall be reared and provided for, which, as I have already said, under the present situation of affairs, is utterly impossible by all the methods hitherto proposed. For we can neither employ them in handicraft or agriculture. We neither build houses, I mean in the country, nor cultivate land. They can very seldom pick up a livelihood by stealing till they arrived at six years old, except where they are of towardly parts. So the discrepancy here is, he starts out the number of souls in this kingdom, okay? We all know what our soul is. We take our souls very seriously. And then he starts counting us and ticking us off as to, you know, how many of us will miscarry, et cetera, et cetera, and the number that he has to deal with and come up with some kind of a solution for. So the discrepancy between part of what he knows and part of what he, the other part of what he knows is extreme. Here's his when he comes to the point. I have been assured by a very knowing American. I love that. I have been assured by a very knowing American of my acquaintance in London that a young, healthy child, well nursed, is at a year old a most delicious, nourishing, and wholesome food, whether stewed, roasted, baked, or boiled. And I make no doubt that it will equally serve in a fricassee or a ragout. Now, if he just said, you know, that a child well nursed is a most wholesome food, it would be sort of funny and sort of, you would see the point. But by adding the ragout and the fricassee and everything, all that language is criticizing, to some extent, people who cook things that way, anything that way, but more so is criticizing people who could value that more than the life of the child that would be on the table here. And so your mind has to go through several pieces of gymnastics in reading that, and you start to realize these are poor people in Ireland that can't get jobs, if you remember the last passage, and Swift is trying to bring our attention to, you know, maybe we should do something about this. An interesting little fact about Swift's life connected with the Modest Proposal is that for 7 years before he wrote the Modest Proposal, he wrote a bunch of pamphlets trying to tell Ireland what they should do in order to take care of their poor in better ways. A couple of them had some effect, but most of them had very little effect. In 1729, he was visiting some friends for about 2 weeks, and he was coming back to London. They were about 3 days out of Dublin, excuse me. And as he was riding back, he rode back half a day, and he turned around and went back. And then in 7 days, he stayed with his friends longer, and he came back and published the Modest Proposal. So we don't know exactly what happened, but I think it's very possible that as he was riding on his horse there, he said, oops, I've got an idea, and I'm going to go back and try to write it up and try to make it work. Now, one of the things that I wish we could talk about, or I hope we'll talk about in connection with irony, is who gets it, okay? The Modest Proposal, I think most people now still think of as the most brilliant short piece of irony ever written. But at the time, Swift had two friends that wrote letters to him about it. One says, the more I think about your proposal, the more reasonable it seems. And another one wrote, I can't bear to think about it any longer, so let's talk about something else. That's all they said. There was a notice in the newspaper when it came out saying that the Dean of St. Patrick's has a new essay on Irish poverty. That's it. No other reaction. I mean, presumably people said something about it. But nowadays, you know, everybody, every school child knows about the Modest Proposal. In those days, when he wanted something to happen, nothing happened. So this great tool called irony, which, if we go back to the earlier points that I made, you know, is a way of getting people to stop thinking conventionally. And in Swift's case in particular, forces you to think in original ways, because obviously you don't want to kill all these children like he's suggesting that we do, or he pretends to be suggesting that we do. So then you have to think, what should we do about this situation? And yet, there's not a whole lot of evidence that anybody changed their behavior in Swift's own time because of the irony that he used. So is it that useful a form? with that dubious conclusion, I would like to throw it open to questions and ask you about, you know, what you're interested about in from the irony that you've read in modern life, in modern movies, in Woody Allen or whatever, how you think it works. Does it make us more intelligent? Does it bring in the reader more? Does it get the reader to share in the same way that I said, you know, nice weather gets us to share? How does it work? How effective is it? What is its philosophy?
Yeah, I'd like to ask a couple of questions first. One is, ironists, like Jonathan Swift and Mark Twain, believed in the power of irony, but like you just said, how much did it change? You know, there's a famous quote by Twain that says, you know, that there's nothing more powerful than humor to destroy humbug. And what do you think that maybe in their own lives, humor was what helped them break through, and irony was what helped them break through to a different, unconventional way of thinking, as opposed to convincing other people of the same thing?
So that it might have helped them more than it helped other people.
Help them personally get to a place where they felt more comfortable.
I don't think, actually, that Swift felt more comfortable mm-hmm. because of his humor. I think Swift, from my experience about him, felt out of place most of his life because of his sense of humor. He loved what his sense of humor could do, but he always had a sense, or often had a sense, that nobody got it. mm-hmm. And therefore, it was just an eccentric talent that he had, and he wasn't quite sure what to do with. On the other side, I do think that humor, I'm thinking of the Colbert Show and things mm-hmm. like that. I mean, I think that humor, which is often ironic, mm-hmm. Does influence a lot of people, you know, and maybe not as many people as the humorist would like it to, but mm-hmm. but I would give some credit to Twain's statement.
Mm-hmm. And the other question I had was, often these ironists, Socrates, even Voltaire, Jonathan Swift, Mark Twain, other famous ones, are considered old cynical grouches. Uh-huh. You know, by other people that they talk like this about conventional thinking or anything. And what in Jonathan Swift's life, you know, you've studied it very carefully, and I've got to mention you have a book coming out, or you're finishing up a book on Jonathan Swift, An Irish Blow-In. Maybe you can talk a little bit about what you found out in your studies.
Yeah, I don't see anybody who's a major writer being a cynic. You know, a cynic is someone who has given up. And anybody who takes the trouble to write a book to try to influence people has not given up. They may be discouraged by the way things are going. And they're often, I think, many of our great writers are often willing to face reality more than many of us are. And so they seem cynical to those of us that would rather have a more Disneyfied view of life. But Swift himself and the other ironists that I'm aware of, Socrates certainly, as Plato portrays him, which is the only way we know him, you know, kept working at it and kept doing it because they wanted other people to see life more clearly and to do something about the problems of life and not just accept them. Swift is not a cynic. Yeah.
Were there any interesting details in your research about his life that are different than what, you know, I mean, kind of a big new idea about what he was like or what his history was? Or,
well, one of the most interesting things I discovered is has to do with his upbringing. His mother was not certainly with him from age 3 to age 18, and many people have taken a Freudian approach to this and said, well, he was without a mother and therefore he was an unhappy person. He needed the love that he doesn't show in his work. He didn't write romantic novels, you know, which he would have, presumably, if his mother had been with him. So although there's no evidence that his mother was with him, there's also no evidence that she wasn't with him. So I spent a lot of time looking at shipping records because he lived in Ireland. He was born in Ireland, and his mother was in Ireland, of course, when he was born. And his mother was back in England by the time he was 18, and it's not clear when she left. In the process of looking up the records, I never found that his mother went back and forth at a time that I wished that she had gone back and forth that would have helped me. But I found that his grandmother went back and forth all the time, you know, at least every year. And I also found records in London of wills of his cousins that indicated his grandmother had given a set amount of money to all of her grandchildren. And I think because people were more male-oriented, they know all about Swift's grandparents and his father, but they never paid it. They never said, once his grandfather died, they never paid attention to what happened to his grandmother. But his grandmother was a businesswoman, sold cattle from between Ireland and England, and I think she was the one who went back and forth and was the central focus of his life. And I do think his mother went back and forth too, but at least I have evidence now that his grandmother went back and forth, and I don't think he had as unhappy a childhood as people invented for him in the past.
All right. Questions? Who wants to be the first?
Okay. Unlikely candidate, Richard Nixon.
Uh-huh.
Four. After losing the election, he said, the press can no longer kick me around.
Uh-huh. Ironic?
Or just painful.
Yeah, to the extent that he was celebrating the loss for the press, I think it was ironic.
Yeah.
But to the extent he was thinking about himself, I'd say I take it as not ironic.
I wonder if one could put a slightly different perspective on irony by looking at it this way. The great mass of the world says this: what's going on is perfectly logical and perfectly sensible. Uh-huh. Now let's analyze it and continue the logic. And we find that when we do this, it leads to terrible results, completely unexpected results that nobody but me has found out before. And now it's obvious that this perfectly logical, wonderful way of doing things is awful. Is that a sort of a basic definition of irony as well?
I think so. Swift, in fact, in a great work, his best work, I think, is A Tale of a Tub, which hardly anybody knows. But he talks about exactly that issue. He says, why should we look into things more carefully? Because if we look into them more carefully, all we'll learn is how rotten they are on the inside, and that we're much better off being deluded than we are knowing things. And he concludes this whole sort of string of logical thought that he gets to that with that we finally arrive at the state of the perpetual possession of being well-deceived, the state of being a fool among knaves. So he turns inside out the idea that it is better to be deluded. And again, you can't tell quite whether Swift would rather have us be very logical and understand all the evil in the world, looking forward to next week's topic, or whether he thinks that we should pull back and have some illusions. And he leaves us thinking about that issue, which I think is his whole point, that he doesn't want to say, keep your illusions, and he doesn't want to say, face all the evil in the world, but he wants to put the responsibility on us. After we think about those issues that you raise, what are we going to do about it? And if he stimulates people to think and do things, that's what he's looking for.
Oh. I've always considered humor to be the saving grace of my life.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And I've been teaching art in grade school for, God, 30 years now, and I've had 2,000 or 3,000 kids. And one thing that I've noticed and very much surprised me when I first started noticing it was how incredibly rare a really good sense of humor is.
Uh-huh.
And I would have thought that high intelligence ranks over a sense of humor, and it doesn't. I mean,
when you say ranks over?
Well, I mean, I saw a lot more kids that were highly intelligent, and I can count on one hand the kids that had a really good sense of humor.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, and there would be a lot of kids that could draw really good cartoon, you know, drawing.
Right.
But then I'd say, well, now what would that say to be funny? And uh-huh. and they don't come up with anything. And I find that very puzzling, because I actually found that, you know, it was even more rare than creativity. And I mean,
yes.
The kids
yes.
are very creative, but they can't just do that twist that turns it the way he's doing it.
I agree. And I guess I don't feel like I'm very humorous by nature. The only thing that I've had luck with is telling the truth. When I've given speeches, if I tell the truth, people often laugh, because there's a sort of recognition that, you know, oh yes, that's the way things are. That's the way things are. But other than that, I don't have a knack. I don't have a knack for telling jokes. If I'm at a dinner party, I'm not the life of the party, all that kind of stuff that I wish that I was. But I think you're right, that a very few people, I don't know what percentage I would put on it, 10%, have a natural affinity for humor in general. Irony is just one form of that humor. Most people are afraid to understate things. That's one of the ways that you get humor, is to understate things. Sometimes you can get it by exaggerating. More people are willing to exaggerate. They love to exaggerate, in fact. If you exaggerate well, you can create humor out of it. The other thing you have to do to see humor is to see the incongruity between different forms of life. Like if you look at all the New Yorker cartoons, most of them are based on an incongruity between, say, being homeless and being a businessman. So they show businessmen asking questions that homeless people would ask of each other, or vice versa. Once you get that knack, you can actually cultivate that knack and make yourself more of a humorist. But I think a lot of intelligent people are basically cooperative. They just want to get along. They just want to, you know, fit in here. And so they don't like that questioning or that disruption that humor offers. Do you?
One more point, I think, is that we can ask questions of each other. So if there's somebody that spoke that you want to ask a question of, let's do that too. That's not what's usually done, but what the heck. So one thing I'd like to say about the humor in answer to your question, too, is I think one of the difficult things for most people is to realize that you are one of billions of people rather than the center of the universe. And I think that when you see yourself in a way which is more lighthearted, because you don't take yourself so seriously, then humor is a fairly natural reaction to a large number of things that happen, which can be taken too seriously otherwise. And I think that idea about how to think about yourself is also extremely rare, and less rare than high intelligence and creativity. And so there might be a correlation there.
Also, people that are intelligent tend to take themselves very seriously.
Yeah. Maybe because a lot of other people don't.
I just thought it bears mentioning that if you look back at Candide, and he has this saga, of course, with his companions, in which, as you pointed out, the absurdities, the ironies, the incongruities. But it helps make the point of Candide that in the end, he is very content to tend to his garden.
Uh-huh.
And if Voltaire were to make that assertion without Candide having gone through those experiences, it wouldn't have been as effective. So
absolutely.
When you show the silliness of the conventional, then the unconventional becomes more meaningful and more persuasive, as Voltaire was able to do in that great novel.
I think that's very, very well put. And in a way, once you read a novel like Candide, you can't go back. You can't take those institutions as seriously as you did before. So in many ways, I still see getting students or children or people or anybody to read those books puts them a notch up, at least, each time they read those books, because they've had this rug pulled out from under them. And you're right. If he just said my overall point is X, Y, nothing. Nothing. Yes? Oh, back there first.
Could you speak briefly about the irony in Gulliver's Travels?
Briefly?
Briefly is at least 5 minutes.
Yes. I mean, Gulliver is like the Modest Proposer in that he's sort of half right and half wrong. He's a pretty humane person. He doesn't, in book one with the Lilliputians, he doesn't like a lot of the imperialist things that the Lilliputians do. And so we start to buy into Gulliver and his way of looking at the world. He's a gentle giant, as there's a moving company actually in Washington, D.C. that's called Gulliver's Movers, the Gentle Giants. And then he goes to Brobdingnag, and they are an attractive and more gentle society. But this time Gulliver doesn't quite get it, because he's so patriotically British that patriotism comes out in the second book, and it's beyond his sense of the possible to be as gentle as the Brobdingnagians are. And we'll skip book three, although I love book three, but it's not as coherent as the other books. And Gulliver gets to book four, and he wants a solution to life because he's been thrown around by so much that he's experienced up until that point. And I think what Swift does is has him fall in love with these horses the way many people do after they get discombobulated in life. They find some ideology that they latch onto because they've been so disappointed by the chaos of ordinary life. And Gulliver falls for the Houyhnhnms, hook, line, and sinker, And they have some good qualities, so we go with him for a little while. And then Swift has us begin to realize, and that's, I think, the really tragic irony of Gulliver's Travels, to realize how awful it would be to be as rational as these Houyhnhnms are and to lack the sort of ordinary, everyday qualities of life, which include humor and which include being friends to people for no particular reason other than that they are your neighbors, they are your fellow humans, they are your fellow Dubliners. And Swift ultimately becomes, I think, a champion of everyday life as a as an antidote to the problems that political figures create for us. I think that's the great irony of Gulliver's Travels, that you can't search for, in spite of all the problems that there are in the world, if you search for a solution that will solve them all, that will be worse than just getting on with your life. I don't think there are too many books that work as hard as Swift does to make that point.
There's a local irony there, and that is what's the name that Gulliver, I mean, that is used by Swift for the human race in the fourth book where horses are in charge. The name of the human race, which is kind of this degraded animals, are called?
The Yahoos.
Yahoos. And that's where Yahoo.com got its name from. So in a way, whoever used that name, Yahoo.com, to get that started was making an ironic joke because he was going out to the human race and was at least hoping it succeeded. So, next. Somebody else?
Here.
Thank you very much. You said irony is to stop thinking conventionally and, of course, to let people start to think in an abstract way. And I hearken back certainly to Virgil and Dante in that regard, and Dorothy Parker.
Uh-huh.
So,
Dorothy, yes.
And I think we're in different spectrums right there.
Uh-huh.
And I think the reason irony, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is so difficult today is because, unfortunately, so many people want to embrace herd mentality and individuality and honesty, as Candide had also in Tartuffe.
Right, right. Molière is another great...
Exactly, yes. Molière, who I wanted to speak about. So I'd like you to say something about the people that I mentioned, stepping away a moment from Jonathan Swift, if we may.
Sure. I have to confess that although I've read Dante's Divine Comedy and Virgil's Aeneid, I don't feel like I understand them all that well. I don't like what I've read in translation of Dante's Divine Comedy very much. I would have said that it was a Catholic apologetic work, which means that I don't think I understand it. So I wish I could answer that question, but I don't think I can. Virgil, yes, had an ironic perspective on Aeneas, his hero. And I think that Homer did, too, on Achilles. You know, so I don't think that Virgil invented that idea. But it is very much related to modern readers and what you said about the herd mentality that many young students do not like to read the Odyssey. They like the Odyssey. They don't like the Aeneid because Achilles is not a perfect hero. They also don't like Catherine in Northanger Abbey, Jane Austen's Northanger Abbey, because Catherine is, in some senses, an idiot, but also just an ordinary girl. They want their heroes to be heroes. It goes back to this Tom Thumb the Great play that I mentioned at the beginning. Especially people who don't have a lot of power like to read in order to read about more powerful people who are succeeding and that they can transfer their fantasies to that person and enjoy the better life that person has. And I think it takes a more sophisticated reader and a more confident reader and one that's willing to be undermined to read about a main character who has flaws. Certainly, I mean, Gulliver's a huge example of a flawed character. But even many characters in Dickens novels or in the Iliad and the Odyssey and the Aeneid, they're by no means perfect, and it's a sign of the maturity of the society that those were their favorite stories. I do think it's that herd mentality that we fall into very easily, very easily, that most of these ironists are trying to get us out of. Yeah. And the reward they give us is you can laugh with me, you know, and we can be intelligent together. You know, it's that old, going back to my comment about nice weather, you know, that we both recognize this. We're both smart enough to do this. We can both see the humor in it. We can both get by the ordinary way people that react to it.
And we can both survive and enjoy our life in spite of the herd mentality all around us.
Yeah.
One comment, and I'm wondering what you think about this. It seems to me that irony might in some way be very self-defeating because it's so difficult, that if you get too extreme in your proposal on the edge, people will just discount it.
That's right.
As being absurd.
That's right.
Leading to non-thinking.
That's right.
But yet if it's too subtle, it won't be perceived as being any different from the argument that it's making. So it's a very fine line, which
Absolutely.
Makes it very difficult, I think.
And you never know when you throw it out. In fact, I'm sure many of you have had this experience yourself. When you make a joke about something, you throw it into a group. You know, sometimes they will pick it up very nicely and understand it exactly the way you understand it or close to the way you understand it. But often it will fall flat because it's not quite the right context for these other people. Obviously, I think most people think that Jonathan Swift is a cruel person because he would even conceive of eating children, right? That's the first reaction I get from most students, you know, and you can kind of convince them that that's not what he had in mind, but they don't, you know, they'll say, okay, that's not what he had in mind, but it sure feels like it to them. So, yes, I think it's very delicate. I think some people maybe were better than others. I think that at achieving that audience effect, I think for the most part Mark Twain did. I think most people think of him as genial and intelligent and critical of society in a way that's productive. You know, of course, but Huckleberry Finn wound up and still is in the courts, you know, for 40 years because people can't quite get comfortable with what he was trying to criticize about the society. But I think in general he was more successful. I think Swift was in a way more intelligent, took more risks, and they didn't all work out for him. I think Fielding is another one, Henry Fielding, who wrote Tom Jones and Tom Thumb the Great. And several other very funny novels, Joseph Andrews. He got a geniality to it and a gentleness. He wasn't trying to change things as much, and he succeeded. I think Dickens succeeds pretty well. I think Jane Austen succeeds pretty well. Well, but some people find Jane Austen a very cold person, you know, because of that irony. Many people are not comfortable with it.
And one other question. The difference between satire and irony.
Uh-huh.
How would you differentiate the
two? I would differentiate them. I spent a lot of time thinking about this. Thank you. better than Dante. But irony is a technique, and satire is an intention. Okay, to satirize something is to criticize it. And you can satirize it using irony, or you can satirize it using exaggeration, or you can satirize it just with a diatribe. Irony is one of the ways that you satirize. Most of the time, if you use irony, the satire will be more memorable. And so that's why people, I think, often put irony and satire together. But I don't want to say that all good satire uses irony as a technique, but much of the memorable satire does.
Next question. Anybody else?
I was just wondering if you could comment on sarcasm.
Aha. Uh-huh. Sarcasm is a form of irony, and it's so it's a subset of irony where you use it to have people see something worse than they saw it before. You can use irony to see things better than you saw it before, or worse. And so sarcasm is, I think, a subset of irony. It's obviously more readily available to our children. They pick up on it pretty quickly. But it is irony. But I would say a slightly less skilled form, and because it's always negative, less intellectually interesting.
I had a question about metaphor.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Where does metaphor fit in with irony? Because so many writers are ironic about institutions at the time in which they wrote.
Right. So like there's a talk about Orwell just down the hall here today, and Orwell would certainly fit into that with Animal Farm. One way that I look at metaphor in connection with irony is that they are the two most sophisticated ways to use language. I think If you can teach students, like as a teacher of English in middle school and high school, I feel like if we can teach them to understand what metaphor is about and what irony is about, they will have a better command of English than 98% of Americans or any other people in the world. They're not necessarily related to each other, but if you use a metaphor, if you can say, personification, I think, is a subset of metaphor. So say an Animal Farm by George Orwell, to take a communist leader, or in his case, it wasn't really talking about the communists, but people who eventually seem to be like the communist leaders, call him a donkey or something like that. There's have him be a donkey in the story and have physical features of a donkey and act like a donkey in several ways. Then, of course, people start getting the idea, oh, Lenin is an ass or Stalin is an ass, right? And so the donkey, there's an element of irony added to the element of metaphor when you have an allegory that's written that way. But many metaphors don't necessarily have any ironic content.
Did Swift write Gulliver's Travels? Were they just stand-ins for really, he was commenting on the politics or the institutions of his day? Or was this his way around, way of making a point?
Certainly a way of making a point. Some people can take every little incident in Gulliver's Travels and say, this is the political reference that he's alluding to. I don't think he was always doing that. I think he's talking more about human nature. For example, they have rope dancers. People who want to rise in court have to jump over a rope, or jump under, actually squeeze under a rope. It's like the modern game of limbo, where you have to squeeze under. And he's, I think, very clearly saying that in order to get the favor of the king and get a good job with the king, you don't need any particular talent, but you just have to do what entertains him or do what he wants you to do in order to stay in the court. And some people say, well, this is how he chose these two ministers. I don't think it's about those two ministers. He's talking in general about how politics works when he creates these rope dancers or the big Endians and the little Endians. Swift, throughout his whole life, was upset by the fact, or exercised, let me put it that way, by the fact that people will divide into two camps no matter what. So we have Republicans and Democrats, we could have Whigs and Tories, we could have any two parties, but there will always be two parties. There will always be some people who have the power and some people who want the power, and they'll be fighting with each other. And so he calls them the big Indians and the little Indians in order to make fun of, it's the people who break their eggs on the big end versus those who break their eggs on the little end, meaning that the ideology doesn't matter much. It's the idea that I want to dislike this other group, and it makes me feel better if I am attacking a whole set of people that have a fair amount of power. I hope that answers your question.
Any other questions? Okay, I'll ask. First, I want to remind our listening audience that this is Gene Hammond speaking on the philosophy of irony and Jonathan Swift at the Commonwealth Club of California. And we have time for maybe two or three more questions. So one of the things that we could do is we could talk a little bit more about Jonathan Swift's life. Because it seems to me that the life of the ironist and what led him to this sort of intense desire to change conventional thinking, but figuring out a way to do it that made him realize it wasn't going to change in a way. Because it's a combination of knowing that you can't change things and wanting to do it anyway. So
that's right.
And maybe we could talk a little bit more about how he got there or what the...
Actually, early in his life, he went to Trinity College, Dublin. And he was a medium quality student. They had to learn, they probably spent 70% of their time on Aristotle. And I think he was a little bit bored by Aristotle. And so he started writing poems, and that's what he liked best. But his poems are fairly atrocious by modern standards. There's one that begins, there's a wondrous joy in doing good. And then he goes on and on and on, So he obviously had the non-ironic spirit at the beginning of his life. And he tried to publish a few of those poems, and he got, in fact, a society much like the Commonwealth Club to publish one of his poems. It was called the Ode to the Athenian Society. and when he was about 23, and he felt very buoyed up by the fact that all these intelligent people had thought that his poem was worth publishing. But after about 3 or 4 years of writing those kind of poems, I think he realized he was going to get nowhere. And then he started working on A Tale of a Tub, where he created a voice or created a persona who was speaking, who was an idiot about religion and an idiot about politics and an idiot about writing. And it allowed him to make fun of all of those groups and the people that he had seen in London and elsewhere who were acting that way. But also it allowed him to make his points ironically as he was putting their voices out for people to listen to. And then he sat on that work for about 15 years before he finally published it, because he knew, I think in his heart, that it would not work. And when he did publish it, it did not work. It's brilliant. We enjoy it nowadays. But it got everybody against him because they thought that he hated religion, that he hated politics, and that he hated writers. So he tried to get into government, but several people would not let him into government because he had this reputation of someone who was, you know, didn't respect the people who got involved in government, and certainly he didn't respect some of them, so they were right. But it blocked his advancement in the church and in government. Finally, he got one politician that accepted him, and then for 4 years he had a great run from 1710 until 1714 with the Tories, in which he wrote pamphlets to convince people that the Whigs were trying to exploit them through the National Bank and a bunch of other things, in which he convinced them to stop a war, the War of the Spanish Succession that had been going on for 13 years. And almost everything he wrote about, he changed the minds of enough people in the population to win over support for the ministry that he was supporting. But ultimately, that ministry fell, and when it fell and the new ones came in, Swift was on the outs because he had gotten so close to the previous ministry, you know, like the Republicans now thrown out, you know. And so then as a member of the thrown-out ministry, he was thrown to Ireland, really, and made dean of St. Patrick's Cathedral. And he took very seriously his responsibilities as dean of St. Patrick's Cathedral, and he did all kinds of things like micro-lending. He would sit on the porch after services and lend money to poor people who wanted to set up trades, and they could pay him back just the same amount that he gave them, and things like that. But anything that he tried to write that was political, he was dismissed. And so over about 15 years then, he worked on Gulliver's Travels, and that was his grand statement. And then shortly after Gulliver's Travels, Modest Proposal, and then after that, he kind of gave up.
Yes. I'll bring it up.
Couldn't Swift's interest in being an ironist come directly from the fact that he was an Irishman who was involved in the British establishment? There's an irony right there that he saw
the
exploitation of Ireland by England, and yet he was part of the English establishment.
I would say that I don't know whether that made him an ironist. It might have. But it certainly made him the first anti-colonial writer. I think he's the first serious anti-colonial writer, and the reason is that he had the education of an Englishman, but he had the experience living in Ireland and see Ireland being exploited. And so most peoples who were exploited didn't have excellent educations that would allow them to write about that exploitation. But since he had that education, it put him in the position. And I think a lot of irony is seeing how people in power abuse their power. And so just seeing that, I think, you're right, it probably contributed a lot to his irony as well.
On that note, from the gentleman sitting next to me, it all brings me to Oscar Wilde, who also was Trinity College.
Right.
And the Irish, of course, have the gift of blarney.
Uh-huh. And some of what this woman is looking for in her students.
Absolutely. We're looking for it always in our lives.
I think the Irish have it to a higher degree than
but
many
Oscar
other people
Oscar Wilde, I think he said something very interesting about San Francisco, which I've just read, that said, sooner or later, everybody ends up, what you see, in San Francisco. So.
Question?
Yeah, Oscar Wilde knew the life of people, like the importance of being earnest, all those rich people, but he also knew what it was like not to be that kind of rich person. And so knowing those two layers of society really does help you as an ironist.
I have a question for either one of the brothers. I took one class in philosophy in college, which I won't tell you how many decades ago that was. What I remember is that philosophy was metaphysics, epistemology, maybe politics. I can't remember all the five or six subjects. But I'm wondering how you tie irony and the various subjects that we're going to be studying here into, I don't know how you define philosophy.
Well, I do think that philosophy has kind of fallen into several subjects, epistemology, ontology. Ontology is the study of anything's being. And so you can study the philosophy of science, of course, which is often studied, but so you can study the philosophy of irony as well. And that goes back to my beginning questions. You know, what does irony, what is it, which is hard enough, you know, but then also how is it connected to wisdom? Does it make us wiser or not, you know, and what effect does it have on us? Those are all philosophical questions.
And I also think that's a perfect question for the final question, because I think I can talk a little bit about Monday Night Philosophy and what we're trying to accomplish. First of all, the word philosophy was created by Pythagoras, a precursor to Socrates. And the origin of the word was that he loved wisdom. It's the love of wisdom, not the love of being considered intelligent, which I think is a more common motivation, but the actual love of wisdom so that you're willing to consider yourself foolish, as Erasmus stated. You have to be willing to consider yourself a fool in order to find something more wise that's available out there. And that is something that, you know, you have to take yourself not so seriously, because you have to say, I might be really good at some things, but I'm really stupid about other things. And Socrates pretended to do this very well, but he knew more, but he also did take it seriously that the main thing that he knew was that he knew that he didn't know. And that's a really big step in the right direction. Now, Pythagoras is from before that, and Pythagoras got so much happiness and pleasure out of the different things he pursued, the different ideas, seeing patterns that people hadn't seen before. There's a pleasure to that which is very unusual, and that pleasure is one of the things we're going to try to create at Monday Night Philosophy. That is the fun or the enjoyment of seeing things from a slightly different perspective, that this is not something to be afraid of. This is something that only puts you in a better position. Now, it may make you look more foolish if you walk away and say, oh, my goodness, I've thought something for three decades, and I'm almost being talked out of it. Tomorrow I'll feel better. You know, and I've had plenty of conversations with people where they said, that's really interesting. Boy, I think you're right. And the next morning, if you see them again or the next day or something like that, they say, how did you talk me into that? Because that can't possibly be right. So it's the motion of the moment, you know, the emotion of the moment. But in general, it is the pursuit of more rational thinking, more objective thinking about the patterns, so that we can have more fun in life, have more enjoyment in life, by not being so wedded to whatever ideas we have and saying, because if you think about it for just a second, you'll say, these are the ideas I live by, or these are the theory, even if you're unconscious of all the ideas, you have a set of ideas that you do live by, and you know, your life is based on that. How much pleasure you get out of it is based on those ideas. Now, if you just hold on to those ideas, rather than be sort of, you don't have to be searching, you know, like the Greek philosopher that went around Demosthenes looking at everybody saying, looking for an honest man. You don't have to do that kind of a daily search for things. But if your mind is open to the fact that if somebody comes up with a better idea, or even on the simplest ground, somebody, you've never liked this one actor, and somebody's always said, they're her favorite or something like that, and you should really go see it, you should really go see it, and you just resist, and you finally give in because there's nothing else to do, and you see it and say, hey, that's really good. So you've slightly opened your mind to that suggestion. And if you just do that a little bit more and just be open to other suggestions, say, there might be some other intellectual pleasure someplace else, or there might be other ideas that may make my life more enjoyable, that's the first step towards what is supposed to be a scientific but philosophical attitude towards life, which is, that you like the theories that you have, the ideas you live by, because they're the best you know about. But there are undoubtedly, not just maybe, but there are undoubtedly better sets of ideas out there. You just don't run into them too often. Well, that's it. Thank you very much.
That's fine.
Once again, thanks to Gene Hammond for the presentation, and we also thank our audience here at the club as well as those listening on the radio or online. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, held during its 107th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.